Okay, well, to start off, thanks to St John's College Reading Group and on health inequalities, and to St John's College, out of which discussions this paper emerges. I'm going to make three points. First, that individual and population level explanations of inequalities are muddled in most policy discourse. Gross categories like socioeconomic status conceal more than they reveal, and the granularity that's required for these explanations has been yet to be systematically developed. We have long-standing observations about health inequalities in the UK and elsewhere, going back to the 19th century, in large quantities, and that's usually expressed in a graph that looks like this, schematically representing the health gradient. Doesn't matter how you measure health, doesn't matter how you measure social status, you get this kind of graph. But that tends to be then underpinned by what I've called the aggregation assumption, which is the simple idea that if you sum individual cases of morbidity or mortality together, that produces population-level data. That's the muddle in almost all policy discourse about health inequalities since at least the 1970s. And the reason for that is that explanations of individual disease outcomes or disease progress or disease causes do not explain the social patterning, and there's a complete absence in this discourse of what I call a social level of explanation. The social analysis is almost completely different. Translated into a simple question, we could ask the question at the individual level, why is Mr. Smith sick? And if Mr. Smith happens to live in Glasgow, the answer to the question why Mr. Smith is sick doesn't give you the answer to the question, why is the population of the health of the west of Scotland worse than everywhere else? You require two different levels of explanation. This seems pretty obvious to me, but it's something that even in the public health literature, the epidemiological literature, is not always as clear as it might be. And as I've said, in the policy discourse, in Wellington House and Richmond House in the Department of Health, this kind of analysis, this discussion, is almost completely absent. So I'm arguing for two related, of course, forms of explanation, one about individual disease states, the other about population level patterning. And in order to understand the nature of the mechanisms underpinning the health differences about which we've heard so much today, and in order to understand those mechanisms in such a way that policy interventions or public health interventions might be applied more forensically and therefore deal with this wicked problem of tackling health inequalities, you need to draw them out. We need, in other words, as I've put there on the slide, to move beyond coarse categories. And at its simplest, along the axis at the bottom, along the x-axis, because we use coarse categories like socioeconomic status or like education or even like income, what we ignore is the social variegation in the population and the complexity of social differences within the population. The theoretical and empirical dimensions and contours of what make up inequality in the population are almost entirely absent and missing from the evidence base. How the different elements of what we've heard called this morning, and I will also call intersections, which I discuss in this paper in 2010, the intersections between social class, occupation, not the same thing, gender, ethnicity, status, disability, sexual orientation, education, income, or any other axis of social differentiation you might want to add into the mix. First of all, much of those are missing from the data completely. How they might relate to each other in either an additive or synergistic way, and what their impacts are on the nature of the outcomes for health inequalities, the mechanisms of health inequalities, is absent from the discourse. To put it very bluntly, in Woody's old stamping ground in the East End of London, I can predict with confidence that the health of the Bangladeshi female population in Tower Hamlets will be poor. But is it the consequence of that Bangladeshi woman's position in the labour market, the occupation in an unprotected labour market, her gender as a woman in society at large, or as a woman in that particular community, the ethnicity and the associated racism, and so on and so on and so on. Which of those are driving health inequalities? Well, it's not one of them, of course. It's the relationship and the synergy between them. But the way that synergy works is something we've done as a public health community very little to understand. The single variables, in other words, are too coarse to capture the social variegation in the population and to guide interventions. What we must therefore do is think in relational and dynamic terms about that woman in the East End of London, but in a sense to all of us. What are the nature of the relationships in which we're involved at every level in order to draw this out? My proposition is that the patterning of national health inequalities can only be, or may best be understood, as an emergent property of dynamic local, social, and historical contexts. And this mirrors much of what's been said earlier today, but I want to bring, coincidentally actually, that together in the explanation I want to make of local granularity. And I'll use an example also from the East End of London. Right out here at the end of the Hammersmith Line is a place called Barking. And Barking is the home, or was the home, of the asbestos industry in the East End. Barking, people have seldom heard of, made famous actually by, well, perhaps not by Tom Cruise, but by this novel, which features Tom Cruise's character, Jack Reacher. And if you've read it, this latest thriller, it's set in Barking, amazingly, in the East End of London. But that's just to give you a bit of background. That's what Barking looked like at the beginning of the century when the asbestos factory was first put there. The chimney on the left is the asbestos factory. The taller building on the right is the school that was built alongside the asbestos factory. The gates to the factory and the school were adjacent to one another, and that's the houses all around the factory. This is a map of Barking, where the factory was in the 1960s. The factory was just up here. And you'd be not surprised epidemiologically to know that the spread of asbestos-related occupational disease, dating from the late 1920s, spreads out across in a direction where the direction the wind blew, which is from the west to the east. And although that factory closed in 1969, there are still cases of mesothelioma which are linked to the presence of the factory emerging still. Is a long latency period from exposure to the disease in some circumstances. Now, I'm interested in two things here. One, the origin of the individual cases, which obviously is caused by the exposure to asbestos in the factory. But the overlapping cases, which produces the patterning, is a consequence of a range of social factors, which are independent, of course, of the asbestos exposure. How and why was the decision taken to site that factory there in 1909? Well, it was chosen because it was outside of the boundary of the London County Council, which had very strict regulation on where asbestos factories could be sited. Barking was chosen because it was just in Essex, just over the river in Essex. What was the relationship between the local council and the factory in that period from 1909 until 1929, when the local medical officer of health first began to identify excess cases of asbestosis, as he called it, in his report that year. So in other words, you've got two sets of things going on. Some of them are political and social, some of them are medical. And you need to understand both of those things operating together to understand the patterning of disease and consequent health inequalities in that particular part of London in order to see what's going on. Just out of interest, this is the site of the old asbestos factory. The council built a new estate there when they pulled the factory down. And with amazing sense of irony, they called it Cape Close because the factory was called the Cape Asbestos Factory or Cape Asbestos Plant. So just in case anyone forgot, they've got that there. The gardens weren't cleared terribly well, and people still digging their vegetables in the gardens find traces of the asbestos. So what are the importance of this? The importance is if we want to understand the particular health inequalities in that particular part of London, you need to understand both the processes going on, and you need to understand it at that local level and then build up the national picture rather than the way we conventionally do it, which is to look at national data and work downwards. And what you pull out of that are some of the things we've heard. The thing that Pablo was talking about most recently about the food environments. Environment is absolutely critical. But we also need to understand what was going on in the factories, the work relations in the workshops, factories, not embarking, but the mines and farms, the interaction between domestic and work life, and also the broader picture of what's going on with industrialization, deindustrialization in other places. Because the experience of health inequalities in the west of Scotland, in South Wales, in South Yorkshire, or indeed following mass privatization in the Soviet Union, is a consequence of a series of localized events which build up the bigger picture. And if we are to understand the mechanisms, we need to understand it at that level of granularity. And built into that level of granularity has to be an understanding of what was going on in the political and power relations in local municipal politics, for example, decisions about what gets built where, how planning is done, about gender relations, about ethnic relations, and about class relations. And some other places, I'm not obviously going to go through the detail, but if you look at the nature of health inequalities in each of these locations, you find they look different to the East End of London, and they look different to each other. They help to build a picture, but if you want to understand what was happening in terms of those patterning, you build it up using historical and sociological data in this way. Instead, what we get from Public Health England is advice to go and get your health checked, advice on individual level behaviour change, advice to eat healthily and take more physical activity, and targeted individual approaches. Individual approaches continue to dominate the public health discourse. And in the 15 years I spent working in or with government at the Health Development Agency and at NICE, two things are absent in Richmond House, in Wellington House, in the Department of Health. One is an understanding of history, and that health inequalities didn't just happen when the Black Report was written. They happen as a consequence of processes that have gone on decade on decade on decade. And the other thing, which I haven't touched on at all in this talk, believe it or not, is a discussion of biology. How is it that these things produce these disease states in individuals? So, whither the relational social perspective? Well, it's certainly not in policy, but one hopes out of events such as this and the sort of things we're doing in the St. John's Group will allow us to bring that social perspective to bear. Simon.
Mike wanted me to talk about the history of this, and it's quite clear, as I've mentioned earlier, that the long-term history in Britain is that the last 30 years since 1979, when the sort of funding of local government was really badly changed, the powers of local government to raise their own rates, which dates back to the 16th century, was removed by Mrs. Thatcher in 1986, I think it's 84. The business rates were taken away in 1986. Local government was turned into a cipher of the of central government and to do its bidding. Now that seems now to be that sort of that's become normalised politics 101 in Britain today, because it's been going on now for 30 or 40 years. What you need to understand is that this is totally anomalous in our country's history. We're a country that's had a very vibrant civil society in association with a very active and vigorous local government, starting with the parish level government that existed for about 300 or 400 years, and still parishes do still exist, of course, and in some regions have a small amount of power in rural areas, as Anne-Louise Kinmonth will tell you. That transmuted in 1834, parish poor law was dramatically restructured into what we call unions, so that they could build workhouses to deter the poor from using their services. And Alex will be interested to know that by the 1890s, Booth and Rowntree found that all workhouses in England were simply full of old people who had just become too old and weak to labour. And that actually was a nice continuity, because the other thing you'll be interested to know is that the poor law had always, the largest item of expenditure going back to the 1590s, its beginning, were pensions and old people. So the idea that we've become long living and therefore the old are a unique and new burden on us is complete cobblers historically. actually, technical term. The old have always been a big part of our social expenditure and our healthcare, and very rightly so, because if you look after the poor, if you look after the old, it releases the young to be mobile, which is a crucial economic benefit of big social spending, which is always ignored. And you go to third world countries and you see why the young are hung on to land and the young are hung on to by the old as their security. If you've got a collectively provided universal social security system that people believe in and trust, then you don't need to hang on to the young. They become mobile, they can take their opportunities, they can go to where the work is. That's one of the things that was a massive advantage for the English economy and enabled it to move ahead in the 17th and 18th centuries. In the 19th century, the British overall health performance at the time when the economy was driving all before it, by the middle of the 19th century, this is the most powerful economy in the world, the biggest commercial trading operation, making fortunes and, you know, really dominating the world economy in a way that has never been seen since or before. And yet, the health of the domestic population of the UK was in a doldrums. And in the cities, it was disastrous. The death rates in Manchester, Liverpool, Sheffield, and so on were absolutely appalling. Life expectancy as low as 30 or even below 30 in those places. Because of that, the overall health of the population simply could not improve because things were going so badly wrong in the wealth-creating foci of the economy. Same thing was happening in New York City, by the way, as I mentioned earlier. That was because there was no effective local government to finance and improve its environment. They did know what to do, although they had the wrong theory, miasma. If they had cleaned up the environment, that would actually have improved the health, because most of the death rates, a very large proportion, was summer diarrhoea, convulsions and enteric fever and cholera and typhoid. So they knew what to do all right, but they couldn't get the political will together to do it because they were under the thumb of what was called the shopocracy. Petty bourgeoisie had the vote, and the one thing they didn't want was for their councillors to start improving the town, because that meant our rates will go up. That meant a cost. So that was a block on it. That block was broken. The Gordian knot was broken in 1869 when the franchise was widened to the working class. And it was led in Birmingham by Joseph Chamberlain, the mayor, and his allies, who were able to put at last a spending programme to the electorate, which was voted on, and Chamberlain was elected three times as mayor, which was unprecedented. And Birmingham led the way to cleaning up its environment. At that point, we can index massive amounts of investment expenditure, and we can see the death rates falling. Life expectancy of the nation begins to climb once again from the 1870s, and it's never stopped since. So it was the locality that drove these national patterns, and it's very, very clear when one starts to look at it why.